Commander Rappard, Reel 24. You were just saying how Christmas 1954, I should imagine, aboard the HMS Superb, you were just sending off the captain to watch the football match on Christmas
I saw him over the side, nobody else had gone. About 25 minutes later, to my horror, the captain arrived back, absolutely speechless with rage, and said that he'd seen the Master-at-Arms being sick in the road, and that I was to arrest him at once. Well, the Master-at-Arms is the senior disciplinary rating in the ship. And I knew that normally he didn't drink very much, if anything. And so I got hold of the chief engineer of artificer, the chief stoker, as being likely most senior, other people and not seamen, and sent them ashore quickly to go and get the Master-at-Arms and keep him out of the way and put him down below somewhere until I could think what on earth we did next. So I duly dealt with that one. And while I was doing it, I went down below, and a few of the other sailors who had been given gin by the sub of the gunroom ran over the brow, because we were alongside, went down to the captain of the frigate squadron, the ship which was just astern of us, lowered all his boats, and took our skimming dish, which is a very fast open motorboat, seating about two or three people in it. And one of the stokers who took that thought it would be great fun to go round and round in ever-decreasing circles, and of course putting up quite a big wave, and eventually turned it over. So I had the Master-at-Arms down below under arrest, the captain furious with rage, Captain F of the frigate squadron having his ship invaded by our sailors. And I had to jump about a bit to find some people who were perfectly able to compete under these conditions. And eventually we got the show on the road again, reasonably well anyway. And I had the only sober diver I could find out and putting a danboy over where I think the boat had sunk and that sort of thing, which was absolutely splendid. And things by the evening, when the ordinary Liberty boat had gone ashore, everything was bearing an equal strain, which was great until the Liberty men in the canteen had a monumental fight with the frigate's sailors and broke up the newly decorated canteen, which was my next little problem I had to handle that night. Captain went to bed and left it to me. Commander didn't want to know very much, and left it to me as a duty officer. And I felt that the Navy had never been like this before to me. It was all new. And there were frightful scenes and punishments and things which went on for days after that. Then one of the midshipmen put a steamboat, which had been given to us, to get the Liberty men into Hamilton, which was about 6 miles away. He wasn't looking where he was going, and he put it up high and dry on a sloping rock on the way in Hamilton. And I was sent for in a blinding rage as the boat officer, as why on earth I'd let a midshipman do that, because I didn't know he'd done it anyway. And I spent the next 2 days getting this blasted thing off the rock intact. So I was very surprised that I was promoted to commander when the next list came through after Christmas on the January the 1st, whenever it was, they announced these things.
1955.
Yep. And it really was very unexpected indeed, the half-year promotion. They came out by radio in those days, by signal. Nowadays, they are announced 6 months in advance of their action date. And the signal officer came down to my cabin with this information early in the morning. I was one of five or six lieutenant commanders on board the ship. And he didn't say congratulations on being promoted. He said, "You're lucky bastard to get out of this one." So it was quite extraordinary as a commission. There had been one other event, however, which I failed to remember, and that was when we went to Jamaica, an official visit again, and we were invited to Government House in Jamaica, Kingston, Jamaica, where the Prime Minister and his arch rival, the leader of the opposition, were both invited too. And first of all, our diplomat there made an appropriate speech. And then the Prime Minister made an appropriate speech. But his appropriate speech was heckled out loud by the leader of the opposition at this cocktail party. And it all seemed so improbable to me. However, the ship was going round to Montego Bay on the other side of the island. And the captain or the commander or somebody thought it would be a good idea if I was sent across the island in the ship's Land Rover with another officer so that I could talk to the man who would be looking after the ship and all the arrangements there and get it all lined up. And I was really quite pleased to do that because it's fun to drive across the country and see banana plantations and all the rest of it, which I hadn't seen before. And we were invited to stay in the house of the mayor of Montego Bay, who also happened to be the biggest banana planter in the area. And I was introduced to his daughter. The signal officer came with me. We were introduced to his daughter. And the daughter suddenly appeared in my bedroom and said, did I have a particular preference for what she should wear at dinner that night? Well, as I'd only just met her, I had no idea. So I said so. She said, oh, well, come and look at what the choice is. So I was escorted down to her bedroom to see what all the clothes were. And she held them up against me, and eventually we got into a drawer full of tights of various sorts, or body stockings, I suppose. And eventually I said, I think the tiger skin ones are lovely, and I must go and have a bath now. She did indeed wear her tiger skin outfit at supper, which I found acutely embarrassing, trying to talk to the mayor and all the rest of her father. And the ship duly arrived a day or two later, and we had all the arrangements made. Everything was going swimmingly. And then I was invited, I think via the captain and the mayor, if I would like to take a car, one of his cars, and a friend, and take his daughter and her girlfriend to see some old friends of theirs on another part of the coast. Well, on the way by, way along past Montego Bay, there's some gorgeous houses there. And one of them had a man who was armed to the teeth parading outside it. And I said, oh, what's that house? And they said, oh, that's Al Capone's house. It was a very famous American gangster. And then the next one down was another infantry, one of the famous actors. And the house we went to, about 30 miles away, was on the coast. It was just very close to where the James Bond creator used to go. And we were ushered into the house, and the man we were calling on wasn't there, or wasn't available. And a black butler duly took us around and offered us a drink, and we said, thank you very much. And instead of going to a cupboard or coming in with a tray of drinks, he started to look behind the curtains and underneath the cushions on the sofa. And eventually he found bottles in appropriate places like that and poured us a drink. I thought it was extraordinarily odd. And then the mayor's daughter disappeared. And 20 minutes later, I said to her girlfriend, is she all right, do you think? I feel worried about her, the way we've just had a drink. Something may be wrong here. And the daughter's friend was very defensive and seemed to be trying to protect her. So the signal officer and I decided that we had every cause to be worried about this, so we went off to search for her in the house, as our host hadn't turned up. And we found that there was a light on in one of the rooms. They had a glass panel above the door of one of the rooms down the way. So I hoisted up the signal officer to have a look through the glass door and found that the mayor's daughter was in bed with somebody we didn't know. And we thought that would be inappropriate. And so we knocked on the door quite firmly. And I sent the signal officer back to get the other girl along, with firm instructions to get her friend dressed and get her into the car because I was going back to Montego Bay and I wanted to leave as soon as possible, please. So eventually we got them into the car with a very, very hysterical mayor's daughter, quite clearly stopped in doing things she wanted to do very much indeed at the time, and which I thought would be inappropriate, especially under my auspices. And we drove back, and about 5 miles down the road, with the signal officer sitting beside me in the front and the two girls in the back, I was very surprised to be hit on the head by her shoe, by the heel of her shoe. So I stopped the car and ordered the signal officer to get in the back and pull the other one out into the front seat. And we had to be fairly firm in achieving this. And I was wondering what on earth was going to happen. We got back to Montego Bay. I don't know how I was going to explain this to anybody. As we drove into Montego Bay, happily I saw the mayor's brother walking somewhere near the jetty. So I stopped the car and got out and said, "Excuse me, sir, there's a bit of a problem with your niece. We've just driven down to wherever it was, and I think she's a bit overexcited and nervous, and her girlfriend is with her, but I'm afraid I've got to get back to the ship." With that chap right away, I saw a ship's boat there, and we ran like hell, left the car and everything else for the brother to sort out. I got back to the ship. I thought I'd better tell the captain that we were in, that there was an involvement ashore of this sort. He thought it was the funniest story he'd heard for a long time, and so we drank another half bottle of whiskey, whatever it was, between us. And no more was heard of it, except that I heard that the girl had been sent to Europe to some of her relations for 3 months or so. Well, fast forwarding to the stage when I was about to leave the ship, my relief was sent out from England, and I was turning over to him everything that had to be done. And he said, what's it like ashore on these places? I said, well, some of the places are hairy beyond speech. And I was just about to tell him the story of these events in Montego Bay, and he said, you know, I came out with a girl who was jolly friendly in that aeroplane on the way out. I came out by the Monarch flight. She was wearing tiger skin tights. I said, was her name by any chance? Yes, he said, how did you know? So I was very glad to be on the next flight home. But the next flight home went to Nassau.
Now, anything else happened before that? I think that,
One of the things which had happened, I'm not exactly certain precisely when, was that in my role as the fleet TAS officer in the West Indies, because I happened to be in the flagship, was to deal with rendering mines safe. And I'd met a shore family in Bermuda who'd invited me to come swimming one day. I said, well, no, actually, I'm on duty. I can't do that. Oh, they said, we'll fix it. How about we ring up and say there's an unexploded mine on our beach and you can come down and have a swim and it'll be a nice way of doing it. Well, the next day or 2 days later, whatever it was, telephone call duly arrived. There's an unexploded mine on the beach. And I was full of sang-froid over this thing, and my chief petty officer was getting all the gear together and said we could go in the Land Rover. And I said, have you got the place, Chief Button? Oh, yes, I got the map here. So we got in the Land Rover and drove off to this place and saw some police there and all the rest of it, which surprised me. And I was just turning right into the road where I knew my friends lived, and Chief said, no, not down here, it's another couple of miles. I said, are you quite sure, Chief? He said, oh, yes, sir, I've just had the instructions on the telephone. So we went on another couple of miles. And to my absolute horror, there was a nasty bit of rusty ironware sticking out of the sand there, which looked horribly like a real mine or a real torpedo. And so my cool and calm ceased to be normal and had to be put on to deal with that. So we had all the houses evacuated on above the cliffs where this damn thing was in the sand, just sticking out about 5 feet. And there was a about 5 or 6 nuts screwing a plate over where I would have expected the explosives to be. And we arranged a telephone line going back from where we had to take this damn thing apart. So I didn't want to countermine it, because it would have brought the houses down or the cliffs down or something like that. And the chief and I then got all the toolkit out, and we found something to put around these nuts, and they'd all rusted solid. So one had to hit the end of the spanner. Every time one hit it, I thought the thing was going up. And eventually, when we got the cover plate off, we found it was empty, that in fact it was an old French torpedo which had been washed up there for some reason, had been emptied of its thing. But I aged considerably in the course of all that, as you would imagine. But we were very relieved to get back to the ship. But on the way back, I confessed to the chief why I'd been so cool, calm, and collected on the way out. I thought the whole thing was a setup.
Any other? So then you went to. You left the ship.
One other story about the ship visiting Nassau. I don't remember in what sequence it was. But it's the most lovely island. And one of the cocktail parties, the beginning of the visit, where the guests were all arranged by the local British diplomats, we had a lot of people on board. And by then, as the officer of the quarterdeck and the boat officer and all the rest of it, I realized that the Americans tended to drink for effect and tended also to have supper before they came to our cocktail party, whereas we were all waiting to have our supper after they'd gone. And so, as a matter of course, I had arranged that a boat stood off the starboard after gangway, and I had a stretcher party of Royal Marines handy in the waist if there was a problem, in case any of them fell over. This was entirely great, but there was another rule that we would receive a whole lot of invitations, all of which had to be accepted. And as the entertainments officer or whatever I was in that particular wardroom, I had to see that the people accepted the invitations. Now, if you had been entertained by Miss Zazala something or other at the previous port, you jolly well went to the Ladies' Sewing Guild and liked it at the next one. And the engineer officer was due to have a rather boring entertainment, I remember. And all that had been said was that come and swim and spend the night. Carr will meet you. And when he came back from that party, we found that the car had taken him straight to the airport with a note from his host, who said, "Terribly sorry, I couldn't be in Nassau, but do come over to the ranch." And he'd been swept off to Texas in the private jet from this multimillionaire, and entertained right royally and flown back again the next morning. And this fitted with, I met the man who'd run one of the major American car companies out there. And he said, "I put my son in charge of the maintenance out here, and my son-in-law's in charge of the sales, and the damn thing still won't work." So it was a great experience, but there was time to recover between the ports that we were stopping at, because it was longer. If you, for example, if you do this type of entertaining on the West African ports, you have an entirely new drinking team on the other side of the estuary of the river, whereas you can be at sea for a week and indeed stop to paint ship if necessary in the West Indies, which was lovely. But in Nassau, we were invited one evening to go and have dinner with a family who'd featured in some ghastly horror story there, where the old father of the family had been murdered. And he'd been murdered, what's more, in the house where we'd been invited to dinner by his sons and his daughter-in-law and by various others. And the captain was there, and I was there, and the navigator was duty officer, he'd stayed on board. And after dinner, I was talking to the daughter-in-law, because I'd heard from the local press what had happened, that this young man had been stabbed in his bed. He hadn't died of it. He'd got most of the way downstairs, leaving trails of blood. He'd then been stabbed again on the stairs and hauled up again and put into his bed where he'd died. So at round about 10:30 at night, and we were just talking about going, the wife of one of the sons, who was a Danish lady, told me about her wartime career in the resistance in Denmark and how she'd stabbed one of the Germans there. And about that time, we got a signal from the ship to say that the wind had got up suddenly. They were on a lee shore, the anchor was dragging, and the navigator had taken the ship to sea. So we all had to spend the night with this murderous bunch of millionaires. And it was really very anxious making, because discussion went on into the night about various things. And one of the people there was the chief of police in Nassau, who had no feelings at all about this sort of thing. Didn't worry him. Well, I did meet one other chap there who was the man who owned Hawker Aircraft at the time that the Hawker Hurricane was being designed in the 30s. And his great designer was Sidney Cam. And the government would give no money towards the development of this new single-engine monoplane. And so this man, in his wisdom, had decided to fund it from the Hawker Aircraft Company. Well, his first wife had died, and he'd married again, and had a young daughter where he was retired, and decided he was going to live in Nassau. And he invited us to lunch and a swim. But he'd also wanted to show me his house on the top of the top part of the island, which really is a lump of coral or rock. But the gardens were superb on his house. And I was surprised at this. And he said, well, I always wanted to live here. And he said, when I found my wife wanted to live here as well, I said, well, I'll have to build a house because there doesn't seem to be anything quite right. So I bought this top of this hill here and went off to find the sort of house I'd like, and meanwhile told them to lay out the gardens. And he said, some damn fool came and told me they couldn't grow anything there, it was only rock. But I told him not to be so silly and import enough earth and dynamite holes for the trees. I told him where I wanted the trees, didn't I? And meanwhile, this chap went off to England, and he saw just the place he liked in Eaton Square in London. And so he bought it, and he took all the panelling out and sold the house again. And found a charming house in Spain, sent his architect to copy it, and had it built on the top of this hill in Nassau with this gorgeous panelling from Eaton Square. And at the time I saw it, the house was superb, the gardens were superb, but he said, it's too far from the sea. I have to buy another house on the seafront. We were invited to go down there for the swimming. The whole inside of that house had been gutted, so there were sort of his and hers changing rooms and all the rest of it. And his daughter was there, aged about 15 or so. And quite clearly, her boyfriend was there too, but not part of the party. And I didn't begin to understand this, but I didn't try to particularly. But I was promoted. My aircraft flew from Jamaica to Nassau, where we were going to pick up the BOAC flight. I got into the BOAC flight there, and this girl, the 15-year-old, was being sent back to school in England on the flight. So we got out quite a long way over the Atlantic. We had engine trouble, and we had to go back to Nassau again. And then we got in the aeroplane to go, and something else went wrong, whereupon she was taken out of the aeroplane because her mother wouldn't have it at any price. Father was quite clearly looking forward to her going back to school, I thought. Anyway, one way and another, about 4 months later, I saw headlines strewn all over the Daily Mirror and everything in this country. Millionaire's daughter elopes with house painter. And this was the girl who was slightly self-opinionated and rather old for her age. But it matched the event in Bermuda, where I'd been given a promotion party by an old lady who lived in the Bermudiana Hotel. She wanted to give a dinner and dance for me because I'd been promoted, and I'd only met her once. And I questioned her at some time. I said, you've got a whole floor of this hotel to yourself, huh? Well, my husband liked it, she said. I said, what did your husband do? Oh, he was Sykes' Illical Gearing Dearie. Haven't you ever heard of them? Well, yeah, but... Oh. She gave a marvellous party for me.
What was it like?
The girl.
No, the party.
The party was marvellous. They asked, nearly all they asked was my wardroom. Masses of girls. And a dance and superb dinner. And I had been allocated a partner for the night, who was an extremely smart young lady. And I got slightly anxious when I was dancing with her. She said something about going back to school. And I said, well, how old are you, actually? She said, I'm going to be 15 next birthday. I got hold of the ship's doctor and said, would you mind dancing with that girl and giving me a professional opinion on how old she is? She said she's going to be 15. So the doctor went and danced with her and came back and said, yeah, he thought that was about right. I was absolutely horrified by this, because what with that and the other one down in Nassau, I thought it must be something to do with the tropical heat in the West Indies. Brought him on a bit quick.
Now, you were sent back to, when you finished your stint, after your promotion, you left the ship then.
I left the ship and flew home.
That would be January 55.
That's right.
And where were you going to?
I was appointed, apparently, back to HMS Vernon as the Commander Mine Countermeasures in the Sea Trials Department.
What did that entail?
It meant that all new mine sweeping and mine countermeasures equipment coming into the Navy had to be tried out by my department. And I took over from a chap called Maine, and the date I was to take effect from the 10th of March, 1955.
And what size team did you have?
Well, one of the members of my team was the gentleman who had been involved with rescue of Bismarck survivors and had been on the same long course that I was on. And he was the diving trials man connected with this. And I had two other officers, and about four or five sailors of different sorts, and another diver one.
And what exactly were you, do you remember which mine countermeasures you were dealing with?
I'd like to mention two particularly. One was a new class of minesweeper that was coming into force, coming into service the first time. And I was required to accept it into service to see that it met the requirements.
So you were on the acceptance trials?
Well, trials meant that you tried it out to see whether equipment was suitable, appropriate for service, and therefore whether it matched its staff requirements, which had been originally agreed for it, and whether in practice any difficulties had cropped up.
And which class of minesweeper was this? Did it have a name?
One's ending in T-O-N, and I'm dashed if I can remember what they were now.
And how did you check it out?
Well, I had the new ship there, newly commissioned. And first of all, I inspected her and talked to the captain of the ship, who was the lieutenant. And I was very surprised to hear that he was far from happy with the ship, because it was the first one fitted with Deltic diesel engines, of the sort that used to drive railway trains around the country very fast. And they had the unpleasant habit of squirting a little oil up the funnel every time they started. And there were baffles in the funnel, and the oil settled in the baffles. And when the exhaust gases got hot enough, the oil caught fire, and so they had fire coming out of the top of the funnel. Before that, the oil sprayed up over the ship, and the sailors were trying to keep the ship clean. And they were a very unhappy bunch of sailors indeed, because they constantly had to wipe the oil off, and it was going all over their clothes and everything else.
Was anything, could you sort that out in any way, or was that insoluble?
Well, it was part of my final report that the ship was not suitable for service on three different counts. One was the propulsion system and the fires and the oil. The other was that there had been economy somewhere in the construction of the vessel, and the way sailors clean oil off anything or clean a bulkhead is to stand on the nearest available thing. They don't carry around a pair of steps with them when they're going to do that. So they'll stand on light switches and anything else which happened to be handy. And the light switches tended to fall off when they did that. Then I took the ship out to sea and made it tow its magnetic sweeps and set out to explode mines underneath the magnetic sweeps. And I had the scientist on board the underwater countermeasures and weapons establishment who designed this stuff. And he said, "You're not going to blow up mines under the sweep, are you?" And I said, "Yes, that's what the ship's been designed to do." "Oh," he said. When I did blow up mines under the sweep, it destroyed the sweep. So I said I felt that it wasn't actually suitable for service because you couldn't actually blow up more than one mine with it because all the